Good evening, y'all.
Good morning. Yeah. Feels like that sometimes. So tonight we continue our Lenten series called A Homecoming. And to be honest, this message ended up in a much different place than I expected because we've kind of been going through this pattern of how God's presence enters into the midst of this broken, fallen world. And this week happens to be on Jesus. And so what you're going to experience is a message that's a lot different than what I had initially anticipated a few weeks ago when I began prepping. And so I want to start with this. I want to set the stage in your imagination. So would you just go into that place in your imagination where you can like visualize entire places you've never been to, okay? So the scene is Jesus is invited to dinner, a Sabbath dinner, by one of the religious elite, one of the rulers of the Pharisees, invites him for dinner. Now, if you know much about Jesus, you know that's kind of an odd space for Jesus to be in because those kind of people didn't typically think favorably about Jesus. And so it's kind of an odd dinner already. And then it gets even weirder because when Jesus walks in and takes his seat, then they all try to play like this ancient version of shotgun where all of them are like calling dibs on which seats they could take because there were certain honors that were attributed to where you were seated. And so they were vying kind of like, I imagine in my mind, because no chairs. So they were kind of like vying for cushions, like, no, mine, you know? And so they're vying for cushions, which is weird. And amongst all of this shuffling that's happening, all of a sudden a man walks up. He walks right into this house. And the man suffers from edema, which means severe swelling of his legs. And he walks up in pain and difficulty and suffering. And he goes straight to Jesus. He knows who he's here for. And he goes straight to Jesus. And Jesus asks the Pharisees, he's like, what would you guys have me do? Should he be healed on the Sabbath? Because that was a major tension point between him and the Pharisees. The Pharisees believed that according to Torah law, that any work, including acts of healing, would violate the Sabbath. And so Jesus asks them, and they're kind of dumbfounded by the question, and they're starting to see, you can like probably just see it in their eyes, but they don't answer because if they answer, then they have to stick by it. So they just say nothing. And so then Jesus heals the man and he goes off in his night. And so Jesus takes the opportunity to begin to tell parables, teaching stories that have very pointed messages. And as he's telling a sequence of three stories, a bunch of outsiders start to come in. It doesn't say if the man who previously suffered from edema had now went and told everyone he's in here or what. But for whatever reason, all of a sudden, this dinner party gets crashed by a ton of people. They're just all walking in now. Sinners, the broken, the sufferers, the outcasts are all now invading this dinner space. It's kind of comical, right? Like it's like an ancient sitcom or something. You're like, what is going on? This dinner party is getting out of control. And Jesus keeps telling stories and more people keep walking in. Tax collectors are now joining in the midst of all of it. And it's getting much, much worse if you are the Pharisees. And so their anger, they finally start to grumble and vocalize it. And they say, this man receives sinners and he eats with them. Like, see that, can feel the emotion of that statement, right? They're asking, who is this guy? What authority does he have to actually be in this space doing this? We are the impressive ones. We're the Pharisees. And Jesus is the disruptor. Now, disruptors drastically alter things, right? Like, that's the definition of a disruptor. And Jesus is definitely altering things at this moment, right? Now, in our modern context, we love disruptors. Regardless of which side you land on any particular social or political issue, either side of any issue typically believes some version that they are the underdog of the issue. And now on the other side, there are those with much more power and they must be disrupted. And so you look for your champions, your disruptors who are going to go in and defeat whoever has more power. So we idolize disruptors, and specifically the ones who stand against whoever we imagine symbolizes true villainy. Now, just think of the recent trend within Disney live action films. I promise I have a point to this. That they cast characters who in the animated versions are pure villains, irredeemable, right? Like you're thinking your Maleficents, your Cruella de Vils, right? But now in the live action action adaptations, they are misunderstood disruptors, right? Maleficent and Cruella aren't the true villains. No, anything that they are doing is simply because there is a true villain who is not them that they are seeking to disrupt. It's kind of telling, right? Disruption is awesome when it is someone else who is being challenged, though, right? Like, I know some people that need to be disrupted right about now, right? But how much fun is it when someone disrupts your trajectory with a thought, a question, a criticism, or a concern? Not bueno, right? Like, so when we either believe we are in the right, when we are pursuing our version of the good life, or when we are trying to avoid our version of the bad life, disruption is really frustrating at the very least. Fair? But what if you aren't living the good life? What if you wake up to realize that your life is filled with difficulty, sorrow, unfulfillment, and then all of a sudden, disruption isn't a bad thing. You want that, the difficult circumstances, to be disrupted. I think of Roald Dahl's classic book, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Charlie, who grew up in an impoverished reality, he now comes and goes to the chocolate shop and gets a bar of chocolate, opens it up, and whatever he had planned for the rest of the day or the next week is an irrelevancy because there's a golden ticket there. That's a disruption, right? And he is excited. This kind of disruption is unbelievable joy because you want to be disrupted. Now, Jesus came to disrupt in both ways. He afflicts the comfortable and comforts the afflicted. Now, you might be tempted to think of all the people in your life that you know right now need some Jesus disruption going on, right? But what if you discovered that Jesus' hope tonight for you was not for someone else to be disrupted, but your life, your mind, your heart? So I mentioned before that we're in the midst of our Lenten series that we've entitled Homecoming, exploring what lengths God is willing to go to bring home to us when we are unable in every conceivable way to make our own way back home. And so we've covered a lot of ground over the last few weeks that before creation, God was present. Isn't that fascinating? Before anything was created, over the cosmic chaos waters, God was present. And then simply by his word, he begins dictating things into creation. And he creates on planet Earth an area, a region called Eden. And in Eden, there is a garden. And in the garden, he places a man and then a woman. And these two individuals, they decide that although they were called to co-labor and co-rule with God, that they wanted to do things their own way. And they give in to the temptation of the serpent, the evil one. And they rebel against God. They want the absence of his presence, and they hide from his presence. And so God promises, though, that although they are going to leave the garden, his goal is not to just vanquish them or be rid of them. His goal is to send a snake crusher by their line who is going to one day defeat evil once and for all. Then we moved on to the tabernacle, this tent that was for the Israelites, God's chosen people who were meant to be a kingdom of priests to the rest of the world. And he said that he will be present with them as they go on the move. Last week, we talked about the temple where God takes that exact same concept and takes down the canvas and puts it in stone. So it would be this permanent fixture where God would be present with his people. And he even promises them that when they rebel, if they turn back to him and to his presence, he will forgive them and pursue them. He will be long-suffering. He will be extremely patient in their midst. But after that moment, there was consistent rebellion by the people, by everyone from the kings all the way down for hundreds of years. And God allows his people who've been clamoring for life apart from his presence to eventually have exactly that. And then there's a period of 400 years where God seems to have walked away from humanity, where it seems like his presence is far, where it seems as if his voice is silent. And so in John chapter 1, we get this beautiful image. in the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Now let's pause right there just for a second, because this is interesting. So what it just said is that at the beginning, like going back to Genesis 1, like creation account, he is saying the Word was present. Now in Greco-Roman philosophy, that would have been a normal kind of phrase to say. What it meant by the word word is, it was the Greek word logos. And logos was kind of this idea of sacred message, overall teaching, the order and the structure of a thing. And so he says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So that's not a crazy concept intellectually, but the Word was God. Now it's getting crazier. And then he said, He was in the beginning with God. So now the Word is personified. The Word is actively with God. And all things were made through him, the Word. And without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And so we get this beginning perspective that at the beginning, in the very beginning, God's presence, his Word was present. Whoever this Word was going to be, he was absolutely there, and all things were created by him, through him, and for him. And so he's crafting all of the beauty of the cosmos by the power of this divine Word. And then in verse 9, he continues, that true light, the true light which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So we sense, as we've kind of journeyed through Homecoming so far, God's presence amongst his chosen people, the nation of Israel. And this what has already been captured kind of tells the story of Israel as well, that they were meant to receive his presence and to live in his presence and to dwell with his presence and to bring his presence to the rest of the world. This could just as easily have been about the tabernacle or the temple as it was about Jesus himself. But God's presence was not received. They trusted the voice of the serpent over the voice of God. But yet the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The word dwelt, talked about this before, is the word tabernacle. He set up a tent with humanity. He took up residence, but not this time in a space that was crafted by human hands, but in the womb of a young woman, guided and directed by the presence of God's own Spirit. And in this fleshly body, in this tabernacle, God's glory is coming near. The same kind of glory that God revealed in the temple was now on display from the moment of Jesus' birth as he grew into adulthood. This is the incomprehensible concept of God, of Jesus being fully God and fully man. Now, humanity has always preferred, though, to live on our own terms, right? Pursuing our desires, our self-interest, what makes sense to us, our hopes, our fears. Those are the things that guide us as individuals. Now, all of this brings us back to our table. This ridiculous table scene, right? Where the religious elites are all calling shotgun because they truly believe that they have achieved the good life. They were always in the right. Their actions were always right, and they were worthy of honor. So why would they want that to be disrupted by Jesus? Why would they want that? They didn't need a savior. Like, sure, they talked about Messiah coming one day, but they didn't want that because what they wanted was the life they had. What they wanted was the better seat around the table. But at the same time, these sinners, these sufferers are clamoring into Jesus' presence in the same moment, desperate for a disruption from their sinful patterns of living, the deep anguish, the deep suffering that they had been experiencing. And so it's in this space that Jesus begins to tell a number of stories. But perhaps the most famous is the last one that he shares, and this is in Luke chapter 15. If you want to go ahead and flip there. This is where we're going to be camping out the rest of the night. And this is a story that we could call the story of two dissatisfied brothers. Verse 11. And Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And so the father divided the property between his sons. Now, not many days later, the younger son gathered up all he had and he took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country and he began to be in need. And so he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and I'll go to my father and I'll say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven,'" which that's was a way to preserve the name of Yahweh so that you would use a code name of heaven. "So I have sinned against God and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." And he arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion. And he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father, he says to his servants, "Quick, bring quickly the best robe, put it on him. Put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet. Bring the fattened calf, kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he is now found." And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and he came and he drew near to the house, and he heard the music and he heard the dancing, and he called one of the servants and he asked him what these things meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come. Your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound." But he was angry and he refused to go in. So his father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you. I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." And he said to him, Son, you are always with me. All that is mine is yours." It was fitting to celebrate and to be glad, for this your brother was dead and he is alive. He was lost and now he's found. These are the words of Jesus. To help me illustrate the beauty of the story tonight, I'm going to partner with some of the masters of the arts from the centuries with some classical paintings. And so we're going to take a visual art gallery tour, as well as I'm going to be riffing on a modern classic by Tim Keller called The Prodigal God. So if you've read that book, some of it might sound familiar. If you haven't read it, read it. It's better than what I'm going to say up here probably. So the first piece of art that I wanted to show you was this one. So this is called The Prodigal Son Received His Portion. This is from the 1660s. It's by an artist named Bartolome Murillo. He's a Spanish artist. And so what this first piece of art displays is how these two sons had many, many desires. The older son, who you see is over here on the left-hand side with his face kind of in the light, that's the older son. And he has desires. He desires to prove himself. He desires to show his worth. And then you have the younger. He wants the joy of all of life. He wants to extract every little bit of fun from his life that he could possibly get. And so the younger approaches his father's presence and he requests the liquidation of his inheritance. Now, This wasn't as simple as, hey, dad, I'm kind of light on cash and I want to go on vacation. Could you just like spot me a couple G's? You know, like that's not what's happening here. In the ancient Near East, your wealth was completely tied up in the land that you lived in. And specifically, even further, for the Jews, their land that they lived in and farmed on was not given to them just by their ancestors before them, but ultimately it was given to them by God to steward. This is why every 70 years on the Jubilee year, if you had sold any of your land to anybody else, and by the way, the only reason that you would sell your land to anybody else is because you fell in hard times and your family needed money to survive. That's the only reason you would have sold your land. Because you didn't like move to the coast because it sounded like a great fit, you know? Like you stayed where your family had landed because that's where God had landed you, okay? But here's the problem. He is asking for the liquidation of his assets right now. And so even worse, an inheritance, something that you get when someone dies, right? Like that's the concept of an inheritance. Otherwise, it belongs to the person who is left alive. And since the older brother in this context would have, according to Torah law, would have gotten a double portion of the inheritance, we realize that this younger son was not just asking, hitting up his dad for some cash. He was asking for a third of all of the land so that he could liquidate it and take the money and run. That means that his dad and his brother and the rest of the family now was living on two-thirds of the property that they owned. That sounds like a big deal, right? Especially when in an agrarian society, your land is how you make money. And so he isn't just taking a third of the land and it's all going to be fine. He's taking a third of the land and all of its future proceeds and profits. And so he leaves his father. He leaves his older brother. Which brings us to this next one. This is also by Murillo. It's called The Departure of the Prodigal. And so the younger, he takes his inheritance and he runs away. Now, look at the grief on the mother's face and on the father's shocked face, right? Now look at the brother. He's cool. He's smug. He's got it together. I mean, the younger takes his inheritance and runs just like Adam and Eve took the knowledge of the tree of the garden, the knowledge of good and evil. They took it and ran. They went and hid on their own terms. So we already see from the younger that he desires his own way over the presence of his own father. So he makes his way to a far off country. Now, in a Jewish context, this would have made absolutely no sense. In fact, the only time that the Jewish people in their entire history had experienced a far off country, it wasn't a good one. It was enslavement in Egypt. It was being carted off into servitude as they were led into exile under different oppressive empires throughout the ages. And just a few centuries before, they were finally, just 4 centuries before, they were allowed to finally come back in and start making this place their home. And so the idea of going to a far off country would have represented a place where God's laws meant very little, where the worship of God meant very little, and where it was nothing like the land of promise that was their true home. So this kid is not just going on a vacation to some other place that looked fun for him. He was intentionally turning his back on everything he knows, everybody he knows, and on everything he had claimed to ever believe. This is a really big deal. And then you have the older son who stays at home. He works hard. He keeps the family business running. Now the next piece of art, this is a painting by Rembrandt. This is Rembrandt and Siska in the setting of the prodigal son, okay? It's kind of odd. So that's actually Rembrandt. That's a self-portrait of Rembrandt, and Siska, his wife, is sitting on his lap. Now, that's a really interesting thing. This was painted early on in his life when he was still a young man. And if you research the art a little bit more, it's actually telling about where he was in his personal life. So it's interesting that he read the story of the prodigal son, and he's like, yeah, you know, like he's like, yeah, like that kind of life, that's the life to live. And so the younger goes off to this far off country, kind of like Pinocchio going to Pleasure Island, this place where there is promise of so much freedom, so much excess, anything you can afford is yours. But soon he spends it all. He wasted all on reckless living, pursuing his own desires uninterrupted. Have any of you guys ever lived an uninterrupted, not disrupted life? Because where it's taken me so many times is where this next painting will take us. This is The Prodigal Son by Pierre Puvis de Chavannes. I'll pretend that's right. Was that fine? Betsy knows French. Okay, I'll take it. I'll take it. This was painted around 1879. And so what he believed was a life of freedom. Freedom. I mean, who doesn't want freedom? He realized that it has left him in death, darkness, and bondage. To wake up in a pigsty. Now, that sounds like a rough night in a sitcom, right, to us. But for the Jewish audience, hearing these words from Jesus, this would have been absolutely revolting. According to Torah law, pigs were an unclean animal. And so because of that, you were not to be near them, eat them, work around them, or associate with people who work around them. Like, you needed to keep your distance from anything this unclean. And here he is hanging out with them, desiring their food. So you see just how desperate this guy is. He even wants to eat their slop. This is the uninterrupted life of the younger. He did things his own way. And this is where it took him. But finally, he wakes up to reality and he begins to come up with a plan to get back home on his own. He's going to work it off. See, he knew he was no longer his son. His rights, his birthright, his sonship dissolved at the moment that he dissolved his share of the inheritance. He had nothing. But he knew his dad wasn't a bad guy. And his dad treated his day laborers even pretty well. So maybe he could be received as a day laborer. So he begins to rehearse his story as he is walking and returning home. If he just works hard enough, if he just becomes like the older brother, if he just goes, maybe he can be accepted back as a servant. He knows he punted his chance at the good life. That ship sailed a long time ago. But just maybe, he could have something other than this brutalized existence that he's been living in. So he makes his way back home. And as he makes his way back home, rehearsing in his head, all of it's disrupted by the presence of his father. Which takes us to our next painting. This is also by Murillo. See, the father interrupts the son's rehearsal, his heart and his mind. Because while the younger son was way off in the distance, the father finally sees the image that he'd been hoping for all this time. This small speck in the distance he knew was his lost son coming home. Now, you may have heard this before, but in the ancient world, running was not recreational. There was no Run Disney events to go and hang out in, right? Running was for young people and for children. The patriarch of the family never runs. It's undignified. It's immature. But the father doesn't care about formalities now. All of that, he sprints to that speck on the horizon line because he knows who that is. He will become undignified in his pursuit of the lost child. So he runs and he wraps his arm around his son, giving him hugs and kisses. And the younger still tries to recite what he rehearses. Isn't that awesome that he does that? He's like, oh, okay. And so he still tries to get off his spiel. But he wants to express how unworthy he is to be treated as a son. But have you ever been so excited when you're talking to somebody about what's coming up, what you're about to go do, that you forget to listen to what they're saying right in front of you? Like, that's what I imagine the father is doing here. The father is laser focused, but not on the words out of his son's mouth, because forgiveness has already been issued. Grace has already extended. So he looks over to his servant instead. He doesn't respond to his son. He responds to his servant. And he says, go get the best robe, which would have been his own personal best robe because he's a patriarch. He said, go get the family ring, which was a signifier of full acceptance and belonging to the family. He says, go get shoes for his feet. Because sandals on a farm weren't worn by day laborers. They were only worn by the family. He says, kill the fattened calf. Their ancient diet would have had very little meat on a regular basis because no things like no refrigeration, no preservation. And so you would only kill animals if you had enough people to eat it. And so to get a fattened calf and to kill that, well, that's another level of epicness because you're going to be throwing a party for the village. Fattened calves are saved for really, really special occasions when everyone's coming over for dinner. So everything is screaming from the Son, I am unworthy, and everything is screaming from the Father, your unworthiness is an irrelevancy. My Son, who is living in death, darkness, and bondage is now but transferred to the kingdom of true light, life, and freedom. He was dead and now he's alive. He was lost and now he is found. And why is the Father doing all this? Does he owe the younger son a lot? No, right? Did the younger son impress the Father by coming back? I don't get that image in the story, right? Instead, Jesus said simply that the Father saw the Son far off. It had compassion in his heart. The younger son blew his inheritance, but the Father, out of his deep love, is paying far beyond what the son could possibly ever deserve or pay back on his own terms. Do you see the love? God doesn't do things because you make him. You can't. I can't. We can't earn his approval. We can't earn his blessing. We can't earn his special touch. We can't earn the answer to our next prayer. We earn nothing. But he gives because he feels compassion towards his kids. And so he throws a feast. And it's epic. And everyone is beyond excited for this moment. Everyone except for the older. It's important to note that this story is typically referred to as the parable of the prodigal son, right? But Jesus didn't start this story off telling about one son, but about two. Two lost sons. Remember, who's in the audience at this table as he's telling the story? Younger siblings. Younger siblings are right there. Everyone who had ever lived far from God's desires, who took their inheritance and ran, they were the sinners, the broken, and the sufferers. So the youngers, they know what this means for them. But the dinner table is also filled with the olders, the religious elite, the ones who had stayed home, the ones who had worked hard to follow their father's commands. Everything they had, they knew they deserved. They were owed. At least that's how they felt. See, the older discovers the purpose of the party and cannot stand it. He stays. He works hard. He does everything right. He did everything that the Father commanded. So why? Why waste it on this ridiculous younger? He's dead. He was owed nothing. All he did was waste what he didn't deserve. And so he refuses to attend the feast. Now, again, in their ancient context, that wasn't just like pressing decline to the Facebook event. What that was public shaming of your dad and his intentions for holding the feast in the beginning. So the father, we know what happens, right? He absolutely gives up on the older son. He thinks about how judgmental, self-righteous, and just a punk this guy was, right? No, that's not what happens at all, right? Just like he went out to the younger son, he goes out to the older son. The father goes after the older lost brother. He goes to him in the middle of his self-righteous spiraling. He doesn't wait for him to be better either. He goes after him. He leaves his own feast to bring the older brother back as well. But he refuses the invitation, right? And it says, and his response to his dad is really telling. Look, these many years I have served you. I never disobeyed your commands, yet you never even gave me a young goat to celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. This is loaded language, right? I did everything for you. But I never even got a goat for me and my friends to have a hangout. I earned it. I deserve the good life. Your younger son deserves nothing. He abandoned us. He walked away from us. He messed up our entire business operation. He didn't even want you, Dad. He threw away at his inheritance like it was nothing. And here you are giving him a feast, giving him the good life, the best robe. I don't have the best robe. But just as the father disrupted the younger brother by his grace and his truth, now the father does the exact same for the older. He says to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad for this, not my son, but your brother. Your brother was dead, and he is now alive. He was lost, and he is now found. Everything I have is yours, son. Literally. Remember, how did the inheritance get divided up? A third went to the younger, and two-thirds goes to the older. So literally, everything that's left in the operation is going to be the older son. So he says, it's all yours. It's all yours. You always have the opportunity to have a feast with me, whenever you want. Most importantly, he's not just my son. He is your brother. And because of that, a feast is in order, because he was dead and he is now alive. And so the father is peering into the heart of the older, and he is exposing everything that's there. Everything that while he never left the family estate, that while he stayed home, his heart had all along been far from the presence of his father. Have you ever been with somebody physically, but emotionally, mentally, you're disengaged from them? That's where this son has been. You're in the same room, but you're not with me. So he worked hard, but it wasn't because he was enjoying working with his dad. It was because he wanted to prove himself worthy, probably even more worthy than his old or his younger, right? But even now, a feast is going down with the best food and the best drink, and he would rather wallow in anger than delight in the presence of his dad and his lost brother and all their friends. You see, the older brother is lost as well. This is a story of two lost brothers, two dissatisfied brothers. The only problem is that his belief in his own righteousness is actually the thing that is keeping him out of the feast. See, the younger son was apparent to everyone who was watching, and that led him away from his father's presence. But the older situation was perhaps even worse, because it was his good deeds that was keeping him out of the presence of his father. See, the heart posture of both brothers, younger and older, had led them both away from the presence of their dad who loves them. And for both, the father was willing to go on a journey to them, whether it was far off in the horizon line or a couple steps out the back door. Wherever they were at, he was willing to go with his unfiltered, lavish love, offering grace and truth to bring them both back from death into new life. And Jesus ends the story there. If you're listening to that story, have you ever wondered, so what did he do? What did the older brother do? How did he respond? Jesus doesn't tell us. Maybe one day we can ask him how the story would have ended if we would have kept going. But Jesus tells a story about sharing two stories right before that you might have heard about, where individuals go on a pursuit. First, it's the story of the lost coin. So a person loses the lost coin and goes and finds the lost coin and then is really excited about this lost coin. So it's probably a collector's item. It throws an entire party over the return of lost coin. And then he tells another story about a shepherd who loses one of his sheep and leaves his 99 to go and pursue after the one. And so in both of these stories, what we see is a clear picture of a pursuit, a full-on pursuit. The coin doesn't magically make its way back, neither does the sheep. But it's interesting that there are those two stories of the relentless pursuit, and then this one almost gives a different impression, right, with the younger, where the younger son kind of made his way back a little bit, right? Curious. But imagine if the story instead went this way. The younger brother goes off on his own, taking his inheritance. But immediately after the older brother hears about this, he gets on his horse and he chases him down. And he said, no, brother, come back home. Don't do this. I'm with you. And he goes anyway. And so the older brother goes to the far off country as well. And every day knocks on the door. Brother, I'm here for you. We're going home. Come get on the horse. Let's go back. and every day and every day and every day until he finally gets on the horse and heads back home. That'd be beautiful, right? Wouldn't that be beautiful? There's a father with a loving embrace. Let's come back home together to him. Now, in their ancient culture, this would have been considered the honorable path for an older brother. The older brother was the protector, the caretaker, the redeemer of the family. And so if anyone was to go and pursue the younger, it wouldn't have been the father, it would have been the younger. But it would have been directed out of deep care, compassion, love, and protective nature. But our story doesn't have that in it, right? Instead, we have an older brother who is way too caught up on his own good deeds and his own worthiness to allow his compassion to stir his heart so that he could pursue after his brother. So now let's look around the table again, one last time, at who's there with Jesus, the youngers and the elders, the sinners, the unclean, the sufferers, the tax collectors, the outcasts, the miserable, lost, younger siblings. And then we have the self-righteous, the proud, the arrogant, those that believe they've earned their own way, the miserable, lost, older siblings. And isn't that the story of humanity? One way is the path of obvious rebellion. The other way is the path of obvious self-righteousness, but it's obvious to everyone but you. See, for Israel as a nation, they had lived as both, but neither of them was what they were called to. They were chosen to be God's chosen people, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, a home of honorable older siblings who demonstrate love, justice, and mercy and holiness to a broken, dying world in their ancient context, pursuing the younger siblings who are far off from God, bringing them back home so that the world would be blessed through them. But either by their squandering of their inheritance or their own self-righteousness, they never enjoyed God's presence through the entire story for very long. They never lived into this purpose. Now, at this point, you might have wondered at least a couple times, wait, I thought this message was supposed to be about Jesus. And it is. Because there was a snake crusher who was promised in the garden. There was a tabernacle who came in the flesh. There was a holy temple who is the very presence of God amongst humanity. There is a lamb who will lay down his own life to be the sacrifice that we can't pay. Jesus. Jesus. See, Jesus is the missing piece of this story. He is the true and better older brother, the one who lived a perfectly righteous life, but he used that to say, come and serve me. He said, I'm getting on my horse. I'm going after my younger siblings. I'm coming for you. I see you. I'm bringing you back home. I'm bringing home to you. He didn't use his holiness as a cause to be served, but to go and pursue the far. And then when the feast is being held for all the younger siblings who have returned, he goes out the back door to look for the older siblings as well, because they're not forgotten about. And he goes and he reminds them of the Father's deep love that's so deep, so vast that it even covers them when they don't even know how much they need him. Because both sibling sets were dead and are now alive. Both were lost and are now found. So come in and celebrate. Come in and experience the presence of our Father, because there is a true and better older sibling. And see, Jesus has come to disrupt the story. He has come to disrupt your story. Being like the younger sibling has an infinite amount of realities, right? If you're far from God, living your own way, keeping certain parts of yourself out of his influence, Jesus has come to disrupt you with his unbelievable love, grace, and truth. He meets you in the midst of the brokenness to pick you up, to get you out of the slop and bring you back home to the Father. Now, being like the older sibling as well is as unique as there are amount of people in this room. Now, maybe you think, well, I'm nothing like the older sibling. I'm nothing like him because I'm not one of those judgmental, hypocritical types of Christians. I'm nothing like them. But you can be of any faith or of no faith at all. and still have the heart of the older, self-righteous, proud, judgmental of all those who you deem judgmental, and judgmental of all those you deem unworthy. And Jesus has come to disrupt you as well with his unbelievable love, grace, and truth. I want to show you one final art piece, which kind of inspired all of this. This is my favorite piece. This is called The Return of the Prodigal Son. This was painted by Rembrandt as well. But his days of living in a far-off land had since passed. This was painted 2 years before Rembrandt's death. It's honestly, to me, one of the most beautiful pieces of art in the world. I realize what it looks like as well, though. A lot of dark colors. It's not on the surface level very pretty. In fact, if you look at the prodigal, his prodigal isn't having fun now. His prodigal has torn clothes. If you look at the back of his head, it's burnt, calloused. He doesn't have shoes on. He's in a rough spot. But if you look closely, you see what the father is willing to do for the son, right? Now, I looked up who the older son was in this image because if you look up in the top left-hand corner, there's just a lighter spot. That's actually, if you look at the full image online, you'll actually see that that is a man. And I thought, well, maybe that's the older brother. And he's like darting to get out of the scene. But no, I actually researched it. And the one who is the older is the one with the face that has light shining on it. See, what Rembrandt was discovering and what he had discovered and what he wanted to put into this is that while we don't know how this story ends, just maybe, the hope and the glory of the presence of the Father would shine on him and he would wake up as well. See, Jesus never tells us what the older brother decides. As if Jesus was looking at the Pharisees around the table saying, how are you going to end the story? Choose your own adventure. How does the story end? Will you begin to enjoy the Father's presence? Or will you not? Will you lay down everything before the Father or not? And see, this is our invitation as well. Every day, tonight, will we respond? Because the Father is throwing a feast and a homecoming feast, and we're all invited and we get to enjoy the Father's presence for eternity to come as the kingdom is brought here to earth. And every single day as we practice the presence of God and sit with him so that we can be sent like our better and truer older sibling who didn't come just to serve and just to be in the Father's presence, but to go out after the younger siblings as well. And this is our evangelistic call, that we are called to pursue the lost, the hurting, the outcast, and the oppressed. We go after those who are far from God, not to convince them of anything, but to be present with them and to display what it looks like to sit in the presence of the Father. So let's pray. Father, I thank you that you have come, that you have walked into our frame as you sent your son Jesus into our story. Each of our stories are unique. Every one of our stories has different struggles, highs and lows, all of it. But yet you have desired to be present with your people. That when we weren't your people, you said, that one's mine. That's my kid. That's my daughter. That's my son. Come home. Thank you. Because you are that good and faithful. So help us, Lord. Help us respond tonight, tomorrow, in the weeks and months ahead to respond to your presence, to invite others in on the story. In Jesus' name we pray.